Hi, I'm Michael Nucifora, and this is Uncommon.
Uncommon is a production by Neural, an agency that helps both brands and talent tell their story. To learn more, just visit neural.com. That's NERALLE.com. My guests this week, Michael Nucifora. We've got CEO and co-founder of Thrive and previously Parkhound. I was trying to find things that I can open with, little icebreakers, so to speak. But all I thought about when I watched your clip on Shark Tank was like, is it all smoke and mirrors? Like the funniest bit I found that, you know, you guys have been given these offers and then they pull you aside and like you obviously need to have a serious chat with each other. But then they've got the camera there like, and it's almost like you guys are trying to say things for the camera and you haven't been given this opportunity to really have a proper chat amongst each other. So I was curious, like what was that whole experience like?
Oh, the whole process is nuts. That particular thing you're talking about, which is when we were trying to make a decision, that is all shot live.
So it's all live.
It's all live. We were playing up to the cameras because you know the camera's there, so you know they're looking for something. But it's all spontaneous. Like, yeah, we were just talking, but the whole process is nuts. From start to finish, a lot of people don't know this. We applied in, say, I think it was February. The show went to air in sort of August the following year. So it's a good 18 months.
Jesus.
And it was a sort of on the whim decision. We heard that they were shooting something in Melbourne. And we went down and did our little pitch. And it's crazy. Like 6 months later, you had to go up and do another pitch. And they're really concerned about the mental well-being of the founders and also making sure that they don't have criminal records. So there's a huge amount of due diligence that goes into selecting you.
Wow.
Because I obviously don't want someone coming on air who's just done something wrong.
Yeah, they're gonna screen you.
Yeah, and they also worry a lot about someone getting rejected on air and how they react to that.
Wow.
So that was quite intense. I remember doing a psychology assessment for like 3 hours.
Wow.
I'm not kidding. And then they have a whole team that do due diligence on the business before you even go there so that the sharks are prepared.
Okay.
But the whole actual show is shot live. You're just sitting there like in a room like this and they go, you're next.
Yeah.
And you walk out. It's crazy. But we nailed that whole pitch, and not to brag, but we nailed it. But they make it look like you take time to respond because they basically shoot footage of you while you're listening to the judges maybe ask a question and then they edit it in as if you're taking time to respond.
But
we had a great time. It was great for publicity. We put a lot of effort into making sure our site wouldn't go down and it still went down. That's how much traffic we had.
Jesus. Yeah, it's funny. Like I find we've had interviews with people like former TV people. Like the Ticker News guy, Aaron Young, is the one I always think about, and he's like, it's all smoke and mirrors. And it sounds like it from what you're describing, like it's very interesting how things are cut. I don't know about you. I've never been into reality TV, but the last season of Maths, I got really intrigued in, mainly because we were getting married, Lauren and I, and I was just like, oh, I'm so much better at these people, at relationships or whatever. But it's just the way that the thing is cut is very, very interesting.
Yeah, you got a little bit of exposure to that because I saw how it went in reality and then how they presented it. And I don't know if you saw, there's a scene at the end, which we didn't know about until we were watching it on air. There's a scene at the end where because we rejected the offer.
They said you were arrogant.
Correct.
I was like, that's just like rude.
Exactly. So we didn't know that, obviously. We're sitting there with some family and friends watching it live for the first time and that happened and we were quite surprised because we actually felt like we had built a good rapport with them.
Mm.
And obviously they made offers, so they felt like what we were doing was quite compelling. But we went in, we had a really specific target in mind. I think at the time we were looking to not give up more than 20%.
Hmm.
Typically on those programs, which you would have seen, they try to rip off. You could argue they're trying to rip off.
They generally are.
Yeah. And we couldn't get down to 20. So we just knew going in, we weren't going to budge on that. The other thing which was interesting is because we rejected, and at the time, I think we were the first to reject an offer on air. Some people reject an offer post the show. We weren't sure if we're actually going to show us on TV because not everyone who does the filming actually gets put on. Yeah, so they sort of pick and choose who they want to show as well. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, look, I used to be obsessed with not Chuck's, what's it called in the UK?
Dragon's Den. Yeah.
I was always fascinated by that, and I just thought, like, it actually is, like, bad PR for some of the people, the dragons or the sharks that are on the show, because, you know, when that specific investor said, like, you guys were arrogant, I'm like, that was such a naive comment, and it actually, like, for any smart, worthwhile founder that you're going to invest in, it would look really poorly on them.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking that, like, wow, this is such a, this is bizarre.
It was really bizarre. We had a lot of positive comments, actually, from that. So, it's one of those things.
Yeah. It's life. It was an awesome experience,
right? I'd encourage any startup to consider going on. I'm not sure if they're even shooting it anymore, but
yeah,
it's one of those experiences where you look back and it's like, it was pretty crazy that we did that.
When you think about entrepreneurship and sort of your earliest inception moment of business, what was it like? What was that for you?
Oh, wow. It's funny because I sort of touched on this downstairs and it was illegal.
Okay.
So in high school, I used to run a bus ticket racketeering.
That's right. Yeah.
So they used to have these old cardboardy paper tickets that you would punch holes in. And one of my best friends, his dad was a bus driver. So he actually had, there's like an official hole puncher. That was the level of security back then. Wow. You know, only the bus driver had that hole puncher, and it was hard to replicate the shape and size.
Wow.
Right? So they had these tickets and it would have the day of the week on it.
Okay.
And it was very easy if you had that puncher. Say one day, one side of the ticket was 0 to 15. Mm-hmm. The other side was 16 to 30 or whatever, representing the days of the month. And if you had that puncher, you could actually easily punch another hole, which would represent that you paid for that day. Uh-huh. So we used to steal tickets, find tickets, you know, and we would use that puncher. So basically, I didn't pay for transport in high school and I used to sell these tickets to people. But what I found was, what was interesting about that is, if you think about it, it's finding or offering a product that in that case was cheaper or for free.
Yeah, yeah.
Than other people were paying, and especially to that audience when you're, you know, you're a skint high school student and you're trying to pocket any pocket money you can, you know, that they used to fly off the shelf basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You would have learnt about product market fit, like product development. So
exactly. And I had this little pencil case full of these tickets and the hole puncher, and we'd made a lot of money out of it. The other thing I did, which was next, was in high school as well, which was I basically bought my way to being class captain, right?
Okay.
So we used to go and do a pitch to the students, and my pitch was every year we're going to have a free fish and chip day.
Okay.
So my friend, again, his family ran a fish and chip business. So leveraging, maybe that's another learning, you know, leveraging your network.
Okay.
And he would give us free fish and chips, probably like for him, you know, probably cost him about $20. It was probably like $100 worth.
Yeah.
And I'd win class captain every year, which was which was awesome. So yeah, I think I was always, and I still am, a little bit of a hustler in that sense, trying to make things happen. And you know, for me, you know, that manifested later in that, you know, I'm always looking for opportunities. I'm always looking for, you know, leverage my network to get something going.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I've covered it in previous interviews, but I had similar things where, like, I would sell lollies from this American candy store in Bentley, and I'd sell it at this high school I was going to in Brighton. But also I had little things like, because my mum would make fancy-ish sandwiches, although I realized early on you couldn't get scale to that because there was only so many sandwiches my mum would make me as extra, because I would say, oh, I need two sandwiches, mum.
So she's thinking you're a good eater.
Yeah. So I'd have like four halves to sell. And I was like, I can only really sell these. Like let's say it had salami and like mozzarella, I could sell it for like $2, $3, like a half. But then like the more stuff that I packed into it, the more value I could get per half. So that was like how I expanded it, so to speak, because I realized like I couldn't scale by volume.
Yeah.
So that was my early lesson, but it didn't last long because I think mum sort of cottoned onto it. We had this tuck shop, which was so good, man. Like, as a kid's tuck shop, I was lucky enough to go to Brighton Grammar because my brother and I had a scholarship, and this tuck shop, in comparison to the primary school tuck shop we went to, was out of control. They had sushi, they had pizzas.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, dude.
I don't think I knew what sushi was till I was out of school.
It was crazy. It was absolutely crazy. They had, like, just everything you wanted, like 4 and 20 meat pies. At my old school, my primary school, they had like some sort of home brand pie or something like that. So, yeah, it was really, really good. And because I would want to get that money to then go buy stuff that was at the tuck shop. So I think there were some things in hindsight that I could have learned as well, like saving my money,
yeah,
so to speak. Growing up as a kid, did you think you were going to be a certain thing, a certain job, a certain type of person?
Interestingly, I, even though I'm short, I was obsessed with basketball.
Okay.
And I played quite competitively through junior level up until about under 18s.
Okay.
And the funny thing was, I actually started playing basketball because I was about the height I am now when I was 10.
Right.
And shit. I literally stopped. So everyone was like, play basketball. And I was quite good at it. And then as I grew up and everyone else shot up and got faster and quicker, I tried to keep up, but I couldn't quite keep up. But growing up, I actually thought, you know, and I was probably naive, I thought I would make a career out of basketball. I think my dad must have been sitting there going, he didn't want to crush my dreams, but he must have known that wasn't going to make it. But I played, I got some great learnings out of that. Just, I used to play every day.
Mm-hmm.
Every recess and lunch, and then about 5 nights a week, there was some form of structured training because I used to play for 3 teams at once.
Jesus.
So I used to play at rep level, I used to play for my local team, and I used to play for the high school.
Okay.
So it's a ton of sport, and but it taught me a lot about team. Mm. I can actually tell now, and, you know, when I work with someone that hasn't played a lot of team sport,
yeah,
I can actually tell. And the other thing is it taught me about training. So just putting in hours and hours to get good at something, and you'll eventually get there, right?
Being, like,
if you shoot every day and you train, you shoot it in the right way, you will eventually become a good shooter.
Hmm.
And it's just something that happens naturally. Like, you think you're just training, but later on I was able to apply that to work.
Hmm.
And just pick up skills and sort of, you know, keep iterating and learning on those things. So I found it an awesome experience, and I think I'd encourage most parents, you know, I've got kids now, to definitely put their kids through some form of structured.
Yeah, I think Lauren and I have spoken about this. We've said, I don't know what your opinion is, but they've got to do some sort of team sport. I don't care what it is. They've just got to try. They could try it. Because actually, when I think about it as a kid, my parents were pretty good like that. Like, I tried footy, didn't like it. Tried basketball, was okay at it, but just too small.
You had the right first name.
Yeah, I did. I did. And then I landed on soccer, which was my thing. Like, I was good at it. I liked it. But I also think, like, a martial art of some kind.
Totally agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't. But I think, yeah, that discipline, I'm kind of jealous. My cousin did. He became a black belt when he was like 17.
Mm.
And I used to love just the thinking about that discipline. And also, I think building, he had some really great relationships with his trainers, right? And I think having that one-to-one type of mentor, which he still, you know, continues to this day, is awesome. We were talking about bonsais earlier. So I think, I get a sense you've got an interest in Japan.
And, yeah, big interest in Japan. But I did karate until I was about, I remember this so vividly. We did it till I was about 13. So we'd moved from Bentley, Moorabbin area to Brighton.
Yep.
My dad had like broken his ankle and was just like looking through the paper and was like, oh, let's fucking sell the house and move to Brighton. So there were certain things I had to change, and it was getting way too hard for us to go from, my parents just couldn't deal with running a business and taking me to soccer, but also taking me to karate every other night. And I remember this, like, I just remember bawling my eyes out, like telling the sensei that, like, I wasn't going to be continuing. Anyway, so I did that until I was like 13, 14, and I did boxing for a bit.
Oh, cool.
But I really wish we had, back then, I really wish like MMA style gyms were around, because the different types of martial arts that you can learn in those places is unreal, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'd actually go as far as to say on this sort of discipline thing, I was actually talking to some friends the other day. I've got some family overseas and they're in Italy and it's mandated that you do some army service.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that would be awesome. Even if it's for 3 months, whatever it is, I think getting kids out, getting them to learn vital skills and discipline, you know, having to get up early, make your bed, shine the shoes, follow instructions, I think that would be awesome. And I think I've got, you know, some nieces and nephews and stuff, and I think they're missing that discipline. I think a lot of parents now sort of worry about being too disciplined, but I think there's a good balance that you can get.
Yeah. Well, I think what Israel has done is fascinating. I think, I don't know how many years service you have to do, but my understanding was it was like at least a year, right?
Yeah.
I've seen these studies done on it. Apparently, it's like the best self-discovery system for one's career in the world because, one, for them, it's quite existential. You've got to learn how to fire a rifle, et cetera. But people think you're just going straight into the army, the front lines, et cetera. It's not really like that. They aptitude test you.
Yep.
They learn what you're good at, what you're bad at, where you can improve, and then they sort of direct you in a way to certain areas of the military that would suit you. Maybe it's logistics. Maybe it's cooking. Maybe it's managing people. Maybe it's psychology. Like it's really, really IT, tech, anything. To me, like growing up in Bentley and the Ormond area, a lot of Jewish friends, they always spoke about it. It was really, really fascinating to me.
Yeah, I haven't seen the studies, but I could imagine that being the case. And I know some people that I've worked with that had army careers and they're always super impressive. So yeah. There's something to be said for doing that. And I think I know it's sort of not kosher here to do it, but I'd be pushing for something like that. Cause I think getting out there, leaving home, you know, most kids don't leave home till they're sort of 27, 28 now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot harder to build that confidence when you don't have skills. And I just think that the system they've created over there gives you confidence or at least shows you a pathway for something. I just know my own personal experience. I was quite lost for the first 3 years of my life after uni, even though I did commerce and that. I think if there was something that I'd done beforehand that just showed me what I was good at, it would have saved me a lot of time. So that's sort of where I'm coming from, I guess. Speaking of studies and whatnot, so you went to St. Bernard's.
Yep.
VU for Bachelor of Biz, then you did your MBA. So you've had quite a lot of studies in there. I know your first corporate career really was ANZ.
Yep.
So lead business analyst, jumping into project management roles, program managers, then you got into mobile, then RBS came along, and then there was this sort of pivot to, I'd say, the tech world, so to speak. So, you know, Lloyds, Euromoney, General Assembly, Venue Mob, all that sort of stuff. It was really interesting. There was this talk you did, where was it? CW Jobs Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
On the wide world of mobile.
Yes.
And I was just looking at it in hindsight, it is amazing to look at that talk in hindsight. And so we'll come back to that because I'm really intrigued about the early days of mobile. But it's really intriguing to see when someone has that segue period in their career in hindsight. But I've got to ask, the time at ANZ, RBS, all those large organizations, were there any great lessons or principles that you pulled into Parkhound or Thrive to this day?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think it was an incredible grounding.
Mm.
And a lot of things I didn't appreciate until I started working with other people that didn't go through working in a large corporate, especially a very structured, well-governed corporate like a bank is. So, yeah, look, the first thing I've picked up is risk management.
Mm.
And I find that a lot of people are missing that skill, and how it manifests in their day-to-day is that they often, you know, if they're leading a particular project or initiative, you know, something comes out of the woodwork, or to them it appears to come out of the woodwork. But in reality, if they actually thought it through, they would have applied some controls or treatments to prevent that risk happening and keeping the project on track.
Yeah.
And I've dealt with people and, you know, they'll sort of say, oh, this thing came up or this thing happened. And it's just a level of sort of immaturity that they have. And it's like, well, actually, you could have, if you actually spent a bit of time, you could have thought of that in advance and put some things in place that would have avoided that issue happening, and therefore the project would have.
Yeah.
So it's funny how some people see it as sort of serendipitous. This thing happened and it caused the project to be delayed, but it actually comes down to poor planning and risk management. So
yeah.
In the bank, you have to formally track risks. The regulator wants to know what your top risks are. If you don't, there's ramifications potentially if something happens that's quite significant, or, you know, if money's lost or, you know, and there were some situations recently, you know, last year with Westpac, and their CEO sort of, you know, unfortunately had to leave, but they had some quite material risks in the business that they weren't on top of. And that's even a bank, right? And they've got a lot of people, they have dedicated teams and technology to track it. Now for us, I'd like to think that as a startup, and for both Parkown and Thrive, we manage risk quite effectively, and I think it allows us to avoid those pitfalls that maybe other startups would have. Now, you're not going to protect yourself against everything, but if you spend a bit of time and you have a process, so we have brainstorming sessions, we have weekly meetings to go through our top risks, and you know we put in place things that prevent those often from happening.
Yeah, I think there's this Charlie Munger quote of like, I just want to know where I'm going to die, I think is like the quote that he has. And thinking about that has always been in my head. And I should be thankful of the area that I got into in commerce, finance, helping me do that. Although I don't work in that area anymore, it really, really helped with that and understanding that sort of stuff. So it's always in the back of my mind, like what's the worst case scenario? As long as you can manage that worst case scenario, like you can sort of act with confidence, so to speak. You know, if we talk about in my own realm, in my own world, applying it today, the biggest downside risk for a small business like me is just cash flow.
Yeah.
Like you can't meet payroll, you can't meet tax obligations, you can't meet basic things. And it's as simple as like every week updating a little sheet on a spreadsheet to show what cash flow looks like on a weekly basis.
And well, that's why we started Thrive.
Exactly.
And every business owner has that exact issue. And it is the most frustrating part of running a business. Often it's one of the most time consuming. And for most, again, it's the most stressful, right? A lot of people, and you come from an e-commerce, you know, commerce background, they hate looking at the numbers.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of my friends, they, as soon as they see a spreadsheet, they just get stressed, just the visual of seeing like a lot of numbers. And, you know, with Thrive, we're trying to build something that does it all automatically for a business so that they can actually just spend their time on growing their customer base, you know, getting more sales, et cetera, which is the part that most business owners love.
Yeah, and we can touch on how you fell into that soon. It's I'd 100% agree with that. I'd spend the majority of my time in things like Xero and stuff like that. And sometimes you can definitely see a future with a product like Thrive where having it just there in the palm of your hand in a mobile environment is going to release a lot of tension and that downside risk. I've always thought that there should be a tool for something like this for quite some time. So it's intriguing to see that you guys have come up with something that, you know, because Xero doesn't really do everything that you need.
No, and it's intentional.
Yeah.
You know, and I love Xero, and it's, you know, not to criticize them because they've built an awesome company. And it's great that it's a local, you know, local-ish business, right, in terms of being formed out of New Zealand. But they are very wedded to their accountant partners. So they actually don't want to close the loop on the product.
Yeah.
Because it would actually remove the need for an accountant. It's similar to what REA or realestate.com.au, they have a similar challenge, right? In theory, you don't necessarily need a real estate agent if everyone's online. I know it's a physical big purchase, so people like to inspect, but you could probably build something so people can still do a physical inspection and purchase the whole thing online. But, you know, they went through this philosophical dilemma, do we do that or not? And they've decided to partner, right, with real estate agents. So I think Xero has a similar challenge. I know that they've thought about automation and all of that, but they don't quite want to do that because, you know, their biggest distribution source is accountants.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and yeah, that's the issue that they have is sort of like they're really a B2B service, not B2C.
Correct. They were designed for accountants.
Yeah.
Correct. And even now you would argue, you know, I've worked in product for many years. Their interface and their usability of their platform is not great.
No.
You know, so, but look, I think they've definitely built a powerful tool. And we think that with Thrive that, A, so there's a couple of hypotheses we have. And some of that's been validated through the research we've done and the fact that we have this really awesome wait list. The first is that people want something that does everything in one place. They don't want to have to use multiple systems. They don't want to have a bank account, Xero, an invoicing solution, and often still a spreadsheet that they use for cash flow forecasting and things like that. They want it all in one place.
Yeah.
The second thing is they want it to be as automated as possible. And the key factor there is, from our research, they spend 6 hours a week on all these things. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah.
53 minutes on reconciling transactions, 50 minutes on invoicing, et cetera, et cetera. And if you said to someone, I'm going to give you 5 hours back, we're going to take it from 6 hours to 1 hour, 5 hours a week, you know, to spend with family or to do more business stuff, that's awesome.
It's like what you said in... there was an interview that you had, but basically you start a business and so you're doing all these different activities, whether it's invoicing, reconciling, reporting, whatever it may be, and then eventually you hire like an external provider to do it, like a bookkeeper, and then eventually it gets to the point where it's big enough that you just hire someone internally to do it. And making that redundant, I think, is while also making business owners more financially aware is probably the way things need to go.
Correct. And look, you would do it and you know, a lot of business owners, they probably taught themselves how to use Google Analytics, Google Ads. Mm. A lot of it's self-service, right? People do it for the first X amount of time. And finances is the same. We think we can get to the point where, you know, the knowledge that sits within a bookkeeper's head or an accountant can be coded. We can recognize a transaction and understand how that should be treated from a tax perspective. We can understand what GST, you know, was applied to that transaction and then pull it into your BAS, right? Yeah. All of that can be coded. And once you believe that, it means, well, full automation of that can be achieved.
Yeah.
And that's just what we're working towards. So with Thrive, as you're transacting and using our bank account, which is really there for as a data source, right? Because we're acting as the bank as well.
Yeah.
So every time you transact or you receive income, we know in real time your financial position. We're able to then code it correctly, apply it to a chart of accounts. And when it comes time to do your BAS or tax return, it's literally just going to be, hey, Jordan, does this look right or is there any issues? Also, hey, Jordan, if you want an expert to look at it, we can introduce you to somebody. So we know some people want to ask questions or they want to get a human to just sort of review it. We'll offer the same thing. If you don't, you can just submit it directly, right? It's all there for you.
Yeah.
And I lived in the US for a few years and that's how, you know, 30, 40% of the market do their tax returns. There's a product there called Intuit.
Yeah, yeah.
Huge behemoth of a business. But it's cool, man. You go in there, it pulls all your, I think they call it a W-40. It pulls basically your income and everything. They pull stuff from your bank account and they just sort of say to you, you know, ask you a few questions. You know, did you earn any money from here, there or everywhere? You fill it out in 5 minutes and it's good to go.
Yeah, right.
And with APIs, open banking, all these other things coming, we expect a day soon that we can automate, you know, all of that.
Yeah, well, I was very intrigued because the angle that you guys took was being a business account or a current account. So really you're going head on with, you're not really going head on with Xero. You're actually going head on with the banks in a way.
We are. We think we're creating a new category.
Yeah, it's definitely its own category.
Yeah, and the reason is that the two categories grew organically. Banking's been around for hundreds, thousands of years, right?
Well, you're bundling the two categories.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing that's interesting is that, you know, say 20 years ago, MYOB was created and then Xero came along.
Mm.
And they at that time had to be separate products. There was minimal integration. There was no APIs. All of those things didn't exist. And what they ended up building was bank feeds. So to sort of pull all that data in to a separate platform and then allow you to control it there,
yeah.
We're saying cut that. You don't need a separate platform. And the way a business thinks is they do business. You know, they want to know their financial position now and in the future. They want to be able to get a loan. They want to be able to do invoicing. All these sort of financial management tasks we think can exist in one place, and that's what we're building with Thrive. So it's a new category in the sense that, you know, everyone builds their own siloed services today, and we're sort of breaking that silo.
Yeah, it's sort of the approach we've taken for the sort of digital slash talent space with our agency. It's what Tesla's done well. It's just integrating as many services as possible to make a better product, essentially.
Yeah, the example I give is imagine you didn't have to have Netflix, Stan, you know, Binge, KO.
Yeah.
You just had one app or one brand. That would be the best. Everyone would want that product, yeah. Right? And that's what we're building with Thrive. And we've got an awesome team. So interesting, a lot of people initially said, you're taking on a lot, right? You're doing invoicing, payroll, et cetera, et cetera. We don't think it's that hard to do.
Well, from a technical point of view, are you building separate platforms because of that? Or like, because my understanding is invoicing is just built in as part of the system oftentimes.
Yeah, for us, it's just integrated. So when you log in to Thrive, there's your bank accounts and you can see all your transactions. There's invoicing and quotes. There's payroll. So they're all features within one product, but it's all integrated. So for example, with payroll, one of the issues with Xero is because they're not connected to the bank account. To do payroll, you actually download a file.
Yeah, I know. It's
and then go and upload it into your bank account because we're the same thing.
Yeah.
When you hit pay, we just use our banking rails and send the
and
payment.
Just pays it out,
But the cool thing is that also then flows into your tax because obviously wages and that need to be categorized and put as part of your tax.
Yeah.
So that's the automation we're building. It all happens. You don't have to then go and sort of work it out or use an account to figure it out. It all happens in the background.
Yeah, I got to say, when you use Xero, it's like, okay, I've got to enter these items and then I've got, you know, everyone's pay and then click run, like post pay run, then you have to file it, then you have to do the super, then you got to come back to do the transfers. You got to export this file, put it into NAB, like what are they called? ABA files or something.
Correct,
like
ABA
that.
Files.
Then you got to do that, and then finally you're done, and then you got to double check it so you know you haven't fucked up anything.
Yeah. And that's what, you know, we remove all that. And then in the future, it can be automated, right? So if you do have a simple business where maybe you've got a few employees, and they're on the same pay cycle. As well with our product, the business can, you know, get an employee to upload expenses and all of that as well. But it just runs automatically every month, right?
Yeah.
And it sort of runs by exception. If we notice something wrong or something different, we'll flag it to you as the business owner. But if it's not, it just runs and you don't have to do anything. So for us, you know, considering when you look at all the pain points that a business has about their finances, we're actually removing the biggest pain points, which is the time element, the cost as well. It's a lot cheaper, and the stress because it's all done.
You, yes, you. Are you intrigued by this episode? If so, go to our footer on the website, NEURALLE.com. We're going to give you an insight each week. It's going to be on business, marketing, or a topic that we covered in the episode at all. We'd love your support and it would help us in developing the intellect around this series. But without going on too much longer, let's get back into this episode. So let's talk about maybe go-to-market, because this is where my next intrigue comes from, is how are you going to convince someone like me to move from Xero to Thrive? Because that's the only issue I see, is how do I jump to that platform in a non-painful way?
Yeah, good question. And it's no doubt one of the biggest challenges. We look at it with two lenses. The first is we'll have a clear program and high-touch process for businesses who want to switch to Thrive. So they've got an existing setup and they want to switch. But the first thing to add before I get to that is only 50% of small to medium businesses use an accounting package in the first place.
Mm.
Most of them have a bank account, but they don't have an accounting package.
Yeah.
So we're definitely going to target those businesses. But for those that already have an existing setup, we're going to have a high-touch program in place, which essentially means we will have content on our site, we will allow you to nominate and basically say, I have an existing bank and an existing accounting package. I want to move to Thrive. Mm. And someone will sit down with you and make that as painless, as pain-free as possible. Now, the other thing is there's a lot of births of new businesses each year.
Yeah.
So that's a key target market for us. One of the cool things about Thrive is the decision on your bank account precedes the decision on your accounting package or any other financial tools that you use.
Mm.
Because at some point you decide, I'm going to start earning some money, or I'm going to start paying for things, and I want to put it on my on a business account. In fact, actually, a lot of people use their personal account for a few months at the start, and then they switch to business.
Yeah,
so we want to nail that. So we want to get that audience onto Thrive. And then essentially, as they grow and as they have additional needs, because they won't need payroll at day one. Often they're not going to have any employees. They won't necessarily need invoicing on day one, but they might need it a month after they go live. So they can then simply add with a click of a button those modules, and there's no need for them to leave the Thrive ecosystem because everything's there for them and it's automated and seamless. So it becomes quite a sticky product. But to answer your question specifically, we will have a team of people that will work with businesses, and we're trying to also build something using open banking, which is now live, to make it as easy as possible for that data to be ported over. And, you know, it's all there for you. So, you again, you don't have to, you know, do too much.
Yeah, because that was the biggest issue, was when you moved to Xero and reconciling every single transaction.
Correct.
That was a fucking nightmare.
Yeah. With Thrive, it's for us, it's all about, and this is everything from the build of the product to how we help people move to Thrive. We have to make it as simple as possible.
Yeah.
And I've sat in the chair of many people as a business owner myself. The thing I love about Thrive the most is I'm actually building something I've always wanted.
Yeah.
So I know intimately all these issues, and I want Thrive for myself more than anything, right? So even with Thrive as a business, because we're not live yet, I have to use I'm not going to name who they are, but I have to bank with another bank for the time being. And it annoys the hell out of me, and Xero, it annoys the hell out of me, all these little issues I have. And, you know, for me, when I think about when Thrive's live, how much easier my life will be, you know, that's a key motivator for me as well.
When it comes to the business model, so first is the acquisition model and how that is supported by the business model. I can make all sorts of assumptions and say, well, the business model is going to be pretty straightforward. You're going to charge like a monthly subscription-based product for the service. I don't know what you have on the banking side in terms of fees or whatever it may be, but I just know from a banking product point of view, you're going to be able to win pretty easily because, one, as you said in previous interviews, the banks don't really give a shit about small to medium business banks. The only way I've been able to get anything done at my bank, because I bank with the same bank as my father, is he's got a large business account and he just kicks up a fuss with his business banker. And then they get out the small business banking team to reach out to me, which is just some call center in Docklands, and their business banker overlooks it. We were chatting about it earlier, like the mortgage thing, you know, because they're trying to mix it up between, are you with the retail bank or are you with the business bank? Who do you deal with? And even when joining up with NAB in particular, and they're meant to be one of the better retail small business banks, like the fees on some of their accounts was like ridiculous. We never got a business credit card with NAB because of the fees that they would charge just for having it around on a monthly basis. And it was just like, well, I'm just going to go with Amex, aren't I?
Yeah.
So from your point of view, what's the acquisition model going to be? Where are you going to focus on acquiring people, particularly these newer businesses that are still like using their own personal bank account?
Yeah, we know that the banks have obviously huge budgets to work with.
Yeah.
So if we only play in the same channels that they're playing in, we're not going to get too far, right? Cost of acquisition is going to be high. If you're looking at, you know, SEM and social, we will have a presence there, obviously, but you know, we need something beyond that.
Yeah.
So we're actually, and this has been our strategy from day one. We want to build a compelling product, get an initial audience, and I'll touch on this in a second in a bit more detail, that becomes rabid fans of what we're building. And the small business community is small, so we're hoping to get a lot of word of mouth and referral. We will build some growth loops into the product, which I'll touch on, but we're going to do that. And I think there's other ones, which are some partnerships that we're exploring. So, you know, you think about large platforms that have a lot of businesses on them. I won't name any, but, you know, often people now, when they're going to get a tradie, they'll go on a website and find a tradie through, you know, different platforms, right? So partnerships like that can be really cool for us, because that business itself, they typically have a relationship that is only at the level of, okay, here's a job that someone wants done, and can you do it, right? Mm. And then the tradie goes and done it. All the financial part of that is done outside the platform.
Yeah, right.
So we can provide a tool now that helps their particular tradie get the money and track their money, but also the partner that we have that manages the platform itself, they can get more insights into their customers.
Uh-huh.
So there's some interesting partnership opportunities. The community piece, we have, we just announced the other day, we have 9,500 people on the wait list.
Yeah.
And our customer acquisition cost for that has been tiny. Mm. You know, it's up to about $9 now. For a long time, it was $6. But what's...
total, right? Or each?
Each,
okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So we've spent a bit on that, but we think of it in two ways. It's customers that they're super engaged with our proposition. So they're already providing huge amount of value back into us from a product development perspective, research. A lot of them, you know, we just had 70 people apply for our customer advisory board. So we're creating a board of customers that are actually going to represent the whole group of customers. So we're trying to pick, you know, a diverse set of business owners.
Mm.
And on a monthly basis, we will actually run through our plans, our product, et cetera, right? So we already have a very highly engaged audience. And we think if we can nail the launch with them, that they're going to go and get 1, 2, 3, 4 people onto the platform. The other thing that's interesting is about our business model. We don't need 500,000 customers on our platform to have a viable business. In fact, because we're partnering with an existing bank, which I can't name yet, we have quite a light, capital light model.
Mm.
We essentially have a SaaS model agreement. So we pay a small fee for any customer that signs up. And anything on top of that that we earn, which you touched on, is primarily going to be subscription. There's going to be revenue around referral. There's going to be revenue from core banking services. So there's different things that people need to pay for. And then there's also going to be lending. You know, we have quite a viable business model that we've developed. So initially, we're only looking to get, you know, we would see success as if we can get to 10, 12,000 customers in year one. That would be awesome. And the main thing for us is NPS and customer satisfaction, and then referral. Like, are these people loving the product, and are they getting their friends and other business owners onto it as well?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense for me. At an early stage, it's all about product.
Yeah.
And like I said, if you could solve all these problems, I would move in a heartbeat. I just know for a fact that even just from a payroll point of view, how painful a lot of these tasks are. And the fact that even that you're bundling expertise into the platform is valuable. We're actually going through like a minor capital raise at the moment. Because of the area we're focused on, the talent area, it does have scale to it. And so we've had people approach us. But dealing with accountants and experts for these specific activities has been very slow. At a time that I don't need it to be slow. You know, I was hoping for it to be done before going on honeymoon this weekend.
So you need some accountants to support just looking at the financials so that you can present them to investors and stuff.
Just little activities, yeah. Like just little things, like something as simple as reviewing a term sheet or something as simple as double-checking a budget or a shareholder agreement. Just all these little things that take time, but when it takes a couple of business days to get a response and then finally it gets put into production, like it all adds up and then all of a sudden you're 2 weeks out.
That's a funny one. I feel like there's two trains in life. When you're in a startup, it's like you expect a response within a day, right?
Yeah.
And then when you're dealing, it's like you're dealing with another planet, right? And it's like other industries and people that are not startup, it's 3, 4, 5 days. It's crazy. But I think, you know, your pain is such a common pain point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Okay, so it's, I'm starting to understand now. I can see where this business grows. I think it's pretty obvious. When do you launch it? Like, do you have a date, month in mind?
We do. It's probably going to be it's a 2-month window around. We're hoping October, November this year.
Okay, October, yeah. November. Have you done? You recently said to me that you did a fundraise of sorts.
Yeah, we did. It was awesome, and it was actually very unique in the Australian market. It's a bit more common overseas.
Mm.
We actually did a combined crowdfunding and high net worth VC round.
Okay.
And I'll talk you through the reasons for that. The first thing is last year when we were approached and we approached some investors, there was some interest in investing in the business. And at that stage, we had a wait list of about 4,000 or 5,000. Okay. And I was chatting to a friend of mine and he sort of said, have you considered crowdfunding as a way to build momentum with your wait list in the sense that they're not only on the wait list excited about the product, but they're actually getting a stake in the business too.
Uh-huh.
So we actually did a survey with our wait list and a good 200 of them came back and said, yeah, we'd be interested in investing if you were going to do crowdfunding. And, you know, that sort of, you know, sort of triggered a light bulb in our head. Up until that point, we hadn't really considered it.
Mm.
We thought we would just do the traditional sort of VC high net worth fundraise. So it became quite a powerful thing because we went and spoke to Birchall, which is the leading crowdfunding platform based in Melbourne as well. They were great. You know, they sat down with us and they said, you know, these are the things you need to do and you know, this is how you would run the campaign. It's quite a lot of work actually, but it's all valuable work because you actually end up sort of working out how you want to pitch your business to investors, which is helpful anyway, right?
Oh, it's very helpful.
Yeah. So we sat down, we worked it out, and then earlier this year, we did a record-breaking crowdfunding campaign. So what ended up happening is we had a few leading VCs and high net worths come in, so people that have been sort of strong supporters of the business since day one. And then we filled it out with crowdfunding investors, so just essentially ordinary mum and dad and people that want to invest in cool new fintechs. And, $3 million in 3 days, which was nuts. And, you know, if you'd told me just before the campaign went live what was going to happen, I really had no idea.
Yeah.
You know, we'd had a lot of interest, but I just wasn't sure if people were actually going to put their hand in their pocket when it came time to it.
It's a lot during COVID.
We broke every single record, basically. Fastest to 1 million, fastest to 2 million, fastest to 3. I think the previous record, we got to 3 million quicker than the previous record to get to 1 million.
Wow.
And the amount of momentum it built. So now we have a group of about 400 to 500 investors who are actually small business owners as well that not only have an interest in our product, but actually have a financial stake in the business too.
Yeah, right.
So we know that when we go live, we're already going to have a good, I'd say, 1,000, 2,000 customers at launch, just because of that audience that we already have.
Out of interest, is there, with something like Birchall, when you do that fundraise, does there become a secondary market for that at all? Because I know there are platforms that allow, like, you know, you've been able to invest in Tyro, however you want to pronounce it, for a long time now. I just can't remember the platform that people use. Is there something like that that exists?
There is a secondary market. It's becoming more popular in Australia. But we haven't seen anyone request anything or we haven't observed of anyone doing that yet. But, yeah, I'm sure at some point that'll emerge for Thrive, especially once we're live.
Yeah. I'm just trying to see if there's a way I can I just want to touch on the mobile insight earlier because, like we were saying, you were one of the first people that realized this was a thing. And it sort of seems like you've had a similar insight to this business financial systems process type area, this new bundling of various services. When you look back at that period for mobile that maybe you've been able to apply in identifying this new area here, what do you think that you saw that others didn't see with mobile and how has that applied today as well?
Oh, it's hard. I think, you know, when it all kicked off, which was around 2009, because the iPhone was released over in the US, I was just enamored with that device. I'd actually always had, they used to call them a PDA, I don't know if you're familiar with that, personal digital assistant.
Yeah, right.
It was sort of the precursor to the smartphone. It had a had a richer UI than the Nokias.
Yeah.
And it had a little stylus. I had a Microsoft PDA. And this was when everyone just had a sort of Nokia device.
I remember that.
But I was fascinated with mobile from the get-go. To me, it just seemed an absolute no-brainer. But you're right. The people I was working with, the people I was dealing with, they were like, I don't know, you know, people still want to use online banking and they want to do this. And I remember getting the iPhone shipped over from the US before it was even in Australia. And once you had that thing in your hand, it was obvious what it was going to become. Because I don't know if anyone, you know, if you remember the original Steve Jobs pitch,
yeah,
it was actually a bundling product.
Yeah,
it was combining internet, the phone,
yeah,
web browser,
phone,
email,
music player,
exactly, music player, right?
Yeah,
and I think it was funny at the time, no one got it, but to me, it was super obvious. When I say no one got it, I'm talking about, you know, to be fair, I was dealing with, you know, I was working in a stuffy bank and you're dealing with a lot of older people that probably aren't up to date with the latest technology. And I feel like I'm getting to an age now where, you know, I'm not up to date with all the latest tech, but we put a lot into that. We were actually the first bank, and I'm really proud of this. I launched the very first mobile banking service in Australia at ANZ. And it was actually live the day the iPhone was released in the market here.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, so a lot of people talk about having worked in mobile and having been there in the early days. You can't get much earlier than
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
And I went and did the same thing in the UK. So we were actually ahead of the game in Australia from a mobile banking perspective.
I've always thought the Australian banks have been, in comparison to the rest of the globe, I know yep. people complain here, they are pretty far
ahead. I agree with that. Yeah. So I went over to the UK about 12 months, 18 months after I'd launched mobile banking here. And I set foot in the country and I had a few connections from banking here and they put me in touch with some of the people in the organizations there. And I went to meetings with them and I was telling them about the fact that I'd launched mobile banking and they just had text banking. So you would text the code and you would get a balance back, right? And so they couldn't believe it. They're like, oh, you've done it. And it sounds weird. I was a relatively young guy in London and I had all these banks clamoring to get me to their organization to launch mobile banking.
Yeah.
And I did the same thing there. I launched, you know, the first mobile banking service at RBS.
Yeah, it was RBS.
Right. And it was funny times because we, you know, we were dealing back then with not only Apple and Android, which had started to emerge, but we had BlackBerry. So we built an app for BlackBerry and we had an app for Windows.
Yeah, right.
So I don't know if everyone remember that sort of tile design they had. They had a really cool little tile design actually. But anyway, we launched with Windows and you know, the rest is history. I had a really, really good period over there for about 5 years. We were launching, you know, some of the most innovative products for mobile banking. We launched the first product that would allow you to withdraw cash from an ATM without your card, just using your mobile.
That's pretty cool.
So, yeah, it was awesome. I loved it. And you know, London's the fintech capital.
Yeah.
And, again, you know, I'd actually – one of the things which I'll talk about later is I often feel like I haven't probably appreciated the situation I was in when I was in it. But looking back, I was working with some incredible people that have now gone and worked at some of the biggest – fintechs, because London's been a fantastic incubator for so many fintechs. And, you know, I was working with them at that time. You know, they've all gone on to really cool things.
It's kind of really fascinating when you think about it in hindsight. Like, I would agree with that. I think the FCA operating environment, the City of London for fintechs is, I would say they're the fintech capital of the world now, without a doubt. There's a reason why the CEO of CoinJar has moved to London. And I do wonder whether that was because of the austerity packages that were passed over there and how most of their banks nearly went bankrupt. And I do wonder whether it just meant that people were more adept at starting these sort of projects. You know, you look at Monzo and Revolut and all these brands that exist now.
There was definitely a smashing of opportunity.
Yeah.
People knew at that time that the major banks, we were talking about Australia earlier, when I landed there, the services were terrible.
Mm.
And you could say, you know, ANZ, CommBank, NAB here, they had some pretty decent digital offerings, but over there, there wasn't. So people saw that.
Yeah.
And there's a much bigger VC appetite for fintech. Mm. It's here now. I think Australia's and Melbourne specifically and Sydney have done a decent job, but there was just a lot of big, bold decisions made to back. You know, no one would have backed a Monzo here or a Revolut, you know, like it was over there.
Yeah.
So you need that. And I think over time, the confidence comes, which is a key thing, right? When people see other startups doing well, then everyone wants to jump in on that. So it sort of becomes self-perpetuating because everyone wants to jump on the next big fintech because they've seen three or four other successful case studies.
Yeah. So it sort of sounds like if we look back at that early insight, the thing that you've pulled from that period and that aha moment, bringing in that iPhone into Australia, was that bundling component, that principle is sort of back there in your limbic brain almost.
You're right, actually. So, yeah, I think I've always found it frustrating when you have to use multiple tools to do the one task.
Mm.
And, yeah, you could say the iPhone did that, right? And I think there's many cases of things doing that people probably don't really appreciate. But, you know, when and this is going back as well, when Foxtel launched, you know, Foxtel's the dinosaur now, but when Foxtel launched in Australia, that was super innovative,
that
right?
All
of a sudden, you had all these channels. You could watch anything you wanted in the one place. And I actually miss those days because now I'm getting sick of all these different streaming apps I have to download.
Yeah, you just want it bundled, right?
Yeah, you just want it bundled, right?
And don't have to think.
Yeah, and that to me is, you know, that's, you know, people just want simplicity at the end of the day.
Mm. Jumping back to the Thrive product, when you think about product development, what are the things that you think you need to nail first off, and then what are the things that people are going to continue to ask you about in interviews after this, like, oh, when are you going to introduce lending? When are you going to introduce that? What do you think of the things that could get you lost in the trees, and what are the things that sort of you need to nail at the beginning?
Yeah, so at the top of the list, we've sort of set this product principle to get admin down from 6 hours to barely anything, right?
Okay.
And if you set that as your top line focus area, it's not necessarily breadth is part of it, breadth of features, but it's actually about going deep on features. So for example, invoicing. We can build an invoicing feature and we have that to me is as good as any in the market. But what makes it powerful is not that it can just send an invoice and you can add items and you can put discounts, et cetera, et cetera. It's actually the automation that we're building because it's the time element. So we go, how much time do you spend on doing invoices today? And what are the things that you do around invoices? And people go, 50 minutes a week. I have to chase up a lot of people. That takes up a lot of time. I have to reconcile things because sometimes the payment comes in and it doesn't quite match up. Cash flow is an issue part of it because people go, well, I only offer an ability to, you know, for the recipient to pay via BSB and account number.
Mm.
You know, some of them want credit. So you look at all those little pain points and you go, well, what's the ones that are taking the longest? What are the most painful? And how can we automate it? So we want to get invoicing from 53 minutes down to, you know, 5 minutes. And that's how we look at things. Then we go to the next one, payroll. Then we go to the next one, accounting and tax. You know, that's hugely time consuming. Mm. So again, we're automating all of those things. So we look at product as initial, you know, it's all about getting deep and automating the hell out of it. And then we move to the next thing.
Yeah, and it's obviously you're going to have more of a competitive advantage there from a tech point of view versus competing with lending. Lending becomes a compliance product in a way.
Well, what's cool about lending for us, which is obviously, it is also the most complex thing we want to build.
Yeah. And the most competitive too.
Correct.
Yeah.
But what we have, which I'd say is a competitive advantage, and it's like a slither of a competitive advantage that we can tap into, is, and I know this intimately from working in the bank, I used to work with teams that were trying to automate and provide simple business lending or simple personal loans through mobile or even desktop. And the challenge they had is the reliance on data that sat outside the banking platform.
Okay.
So if you want to do a business lend today, you can't just use the transaction data that the business has.
Yeah, yeah.
You need to go and ask that business, can you provide your last few BAS returns, your last tax return, and a profit and loss, et cetera, et cetera. That's the time consuming bit. Once the bank has the data, the decisioning is quite
quick. It's like immediate, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, most of the time it's automated. Sometimes it goes, you know, if there's an edge case, it'll go to a human to review. Now, for us, because we're breaking down the silo, because we're doing the accounting and tax, because we're doing the BAS, we don't need to go and ask that business to provide additional information that we don't have.
Yeah.
We're going to have it all in our system. That's where it becomes really powerful and sticky. The more you use Thrive, the more your life becomes easier,
yeah,
and the easier it becomes for us to actually lend to you. So what will happen in the future is if you're a customer that's using us for invoicing, payroll, et cetera, tax, all you have to literally do is click a button to get a loan because we'll, yeah, know exactly what we're happy to give you and at what rate.
You can be proactive about it too. You can, yep, say, hey, have you considered taking this sort of loan for this because you've got that insight about them? Yeah.
And 100%. It can be really targeted, right? Like because we're having invoicing, when you send an invoice, and if you're a solid business, but for whatever reason, maybe your cash flow is a bit low at that point in time, we can give you invoice finance then and there because you're using us to do the invoice. So the fact that we have a broader offering and a deeper offering allows us to streamline lending, potentially give it at a better rate because we understand the full 360 of that business. But yeah, it's definitely something we're working on and it's going to take a while to get there. But I'm hoping that we can get there because beyond the admin piece and just the day-to-day needs that a business has to make payments and receive money, there's no doubt that getting working capital is important. And we want to do that. And I'm sick of hearing about businesses that are very solid businesses, but there's this sort of computer says no thing, right? And the banks, you know, I've had so many mates, you know, one runs a really successful cafe and he struggles to get like a credit card just to like, you know, help out with working cash flow and things like that. And that's why these buy now, pay laters and things have emerged because there's gaps and you know, a lot of them are being picked off by different fintechs now.
Yeah.
We happen to think this sort of business banking and accounting piece is a gap and that's what we're trying to address.
Before we get into these rapid fire questions, I've got to ask, you do a lot of these, you've done a few of these interviews now. What's the topic you wish you could talk about in interviews that you don't get asked?
Ooh, it's probably controversial, but I don't think we as a human race and for everything we've achieved, I think about 20% of people actually put in the work.
Yeah, right.
And that annoys me. I meet so many talented people. I wouldn't even say I'm talented or smart. I just think I'm probably in the top 1% of work ethic and therefore I've managed to sort of carve out some things, right? But I meet so many people that I've worked with and super talented, super bright. They can understand a concept that would take me days to figure out instantly, but they just don't have the work ethic. And
they
can't
apply it, yeah.
Yeah, and that to me, you think about it at a global level, you know, how much better or further progressed and things we could be if everybody, and I guess that's just part of life. I've grown to accept it a little bit, but to me, it's a frustration. Like I meet so many talented people that just don't get the most out of themselves.
Yeah, it's funny because I have this with my brother because he's exceptionally smart. Like he's got an IQ of about 140.
Yeah.
I think though, there's a correlation between IQ and conscientiousness, like that as a personality trait. I read this thing the other day that like the smartest guy in the world who's got like an IQ of like 160, he's a bouncer because he can't function normally.
Wow.
Like he just can't bring it all together because he's just not conscientious. That's interesting, too, yeah. And he gets bored with things. My brother has that too. He gets bored with things way too easily.
Yeah.
He's on his third degree because he's just bored.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think I would 100% agree with that. All right. Rapid fire questions. Movie of choice?
Gattaca.
Gattaca? Okay. Great movie.
It's an awesome classic movie. And I actually resonate a lot with Vincent. Right. And the reason is like he's in a world where, and we're just touching on this, right? There's a lot of talented people and he has to really grind his way through life and he ends up getting there. I just love the scene, if you've seen the movie, where there's the swim at the end It's just crazy. It gets me every time.
It's actually a great film, but actually, I think about it. My partner, she's not seen it. Maybe it's one of those ones I can rewatch.
I think it's an undercooked sort of classic. I don't think a lot of people have actually seen it. Right? No. It's an awesome movie.
And last question for you, quote that you live by or think of often.
It's my second favorite movie, The Matrix, and it's Morpheus goes, "There's a difference between knowing the path and walking the path."
Okay.
And I love that quote. And again, comes back to this thing. I think a lot of people know what they want to do, or they know, you know, how they should do it, but actually just don't go and do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think there's so much literature, there's so much content. You can learn anything that if you want to do, you know, if you want to do something, you can do it. And, I just love that quote that, you know, it's basically saying you know what you want to do and you just need to go and do it.
Yeah, or they think they should know the path and therefore don't go and do it.
Yeah.
Mate, it's been great having you in.
Thank you.
Michael, where can people find you on the interwebs? Where can they find Thrive?
Okay, so our domain is plusthrive.com, which is P-L-U-S, Thrive. We are on all the socials, Plus Thrive. And I'm very responsive on LinkedIn, so if people want to connect with me on LinkedIn, just reach out. And, yeah,
unless you're selling IT services or development teams.
Post-funding, we've got a ton of that, so yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Michael Nutrifora, thank you so much for coming in. It's been a pleasure having you on, and thanks a lot.
Awesome, Jordan. Thank you.
Thank you so much for checking out this episode. If you do like it, please subscribe and, of course, like if you're watching the YouTube video as well. We'd really appreciate that. You can also find our Clips channel in the description. For audio, if you're not already listening, you can search Uncommon on Pocket Cast, Spotify and Apple Podcasts quite easily. For video, if you're not watching, you can search Uncommon on YouTube. And for behind the scenes takes and clips on social media, then definitely check out @uncommon_show on Instagram. But otherwise, look, thanks so much for tuning in, and until next time, thanks for listening.